I'd like to call the 2007 Oregon State Legislature House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. And I want to thank all the people here, first of all, for showing up. And I would like to start out by introducing my committee members. And I think we'll just start to the left.
Okay. You want me to introduce Representative Patty Smith, District 52, East Multnomah, East Clackamas, and all of Hood River County, and I'm very glad to be on this committee. I'm a consumer, too.
Representative Larry Galizio, House District 35, which is Tigard and King City and a little bit of southwest Portland.
I'm Representative Suzanne Bonamici. I represent House District 34, which is Washington County. I do have a legal background in consumer protection. It's been a few years, but I did work at the Federal Trade Commission Bureau of Consumer Protection Credit Practice Division.
And on my far right,
Representative Chuck Riley, House District 29, the heart of Washington County, Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. And like Representative Smith, I'm happy to be on this committee because I'm a consumer as well.
And I'm Vic Gilliam. I'm representing District 18, Max Sumner's district. I was appointed over the holiday, and it's parts of Clackamas and Marion County.
And my vice chair, Donna Nelson, couldn't make it today because of road conditions. I heard she was trying to, but I guess it was pretty icy out her way still. So I am the chair, and my name is Paul Holby. I'm the state representative from District 8, which is Eugene and parts of western and southern central Lane County, taking in Vinita, Lorain, and a little bit of Notai and Alma and Crow, Fern Ridge Reservoir. And we're looking forward to this committee. We have a lot of work to do this session in a short time frame, and so we're going to try to stay focused on the agendas at hand and keep this committee moving. And I look forward to hearing from everybody on the issues. I want to make sure I have a good airing of everything. And from there, I'd like to move to our organizational meeting and adopt the rules. I believe we have copies of that. Hopefully the committee's reviewed those rules. I may point out if you had a set of rules earlier that on item 13 that had session days in item 13, it was an error, and it should be business days. So just to bring that to the committee's attention, if everybody's had time to review them, I would like a motion to adopt.
I'll make a motion to adopt the House rules on the Committee on Consumer Protection.
Any discussion? Any objections? The rules are adopted.
Mr. Chair, can we have the committee staff introduce themselves as well, please?
Oh, sure. Thank you for that oversight on my part.
Sure. I'm Steve Dixon. I'm the committee administrator for the House Consumer Protection Committee, and working mostly with the chair of the committee, Representative Holby, but I wanted to make everyone aware that I will be available as a resource to your offices when you need me.
Mike Riley, great assistant in my fourth session here. I worked with you before, I think, in the interim a little bit.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to close the organizational hearing and open up an informational hearing. And today we're going to have an overview from Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, followed up with an informational meeting from the Oregon Department of Justice, Attorney in Charge Drew Loyanopoulos. I hope I didn't butcher your name. And with that, I'd like to call Ms. Streisinger up, and if you have any staff that you'd like to come up with you, that'd be quite acceptable as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Corey Strasinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I do have a couple of my administrators with me who I would like to introduce, and then we can get into areas where they need to come up and assist. We will do that, but you will be getting to know them, I think, as the session goes forward, so I did want to at least introduce them today. We have Mark Long, who is the Administrator of the Building Codes Division, and I think many of you know and have worked with Mark. And sitting next to him is David Tatman, the administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And Joel Ario, who is our administrator of our Insurance Division, may be here a little later. And if so, and if I catch him out of the corner of my eye, I'll make sure to introduce him as well. So, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. We are a consumer protection agency as well as a business regulatory agency. And what I'm going to do today, subject to what you would like me to talk about in more or less detail, is give you an overview of the agency as a whole, but focus on our consumer protection work. And in front of you, as well as the prepared testimony, you should have a packet that looks like this, and I will be, I see it's coming your way, referring to some of the materials in it as I go forward. As I said, Department of Consumer and Business Services, or DCBS. I see Joel Ario has just walked in. Joel is the administrator of our insurance division, and you will undoubtedly be seeing a lot of him as well as the session goes forward. The Department of Consumer and Business Services, or DCBS, is, as I said, the state's largest regulatory and consumer protection agency. And our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. And those two halves of the mission, in our view, go together. They're not opposites to each other. We believe that a good, strong regulatory system is one that protects consumers and workers and also is good for regulated businesses. And that's how we try to look at our tasks in our agency. We include the Workers' Compensation Division, Oregon OSHA, insurance, building codes, finance and corporate securities, and then a number of smaller programs, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses, which certifies small firms for government contracting opportunities, and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which works with business regulatory agencies statewide on ways to make it easier for businesses, easier, cheaper, and quicker for businesses to do business with government. As a whole, on an agency-wide basis, we have some sort of philosophies or strategies that we try to use in approaching our work. We try to focus on real concerns and problems and to improve outcomes rather than just processes. We try to structure our regulatory programs so that they impose the minimum burden on the businesses that we regulate, but consistent with the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. We try to use a variety of approaches, so education and consultation as well as regulation and enforcement. And in the packet, you'll see some examples of our educational materials and outreach materials. We're strong believers in customer service. We try to use technology creatively to make it easier to do business with us. And we also try to measure whether our programs are delivering value for consumers and workers and the businesses that we regulate. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Oregon OSHA and workers' compensation because they are primarily worker protection programs rather than consumer protection programs, and my understanding is that they won't basically be within this committee's jurisdiction. I do want to mention them briefly, though, because you as individual legislators, of course, I know care about those issues, and you may also have constituents who contact you about those issues. So just very briefly, of course, through Oregon OSHA, we administer a state plan. Some states, OSHA is entirely federal, but here we administer a state plan that's consistent with federal requirements through which we promulgate safety and health rules. Of course, we do enforcement, and we also do consultation that's available to businesses on a voluntary basis. We work hard on outreach, particularly with hard-to-reach populations, what's one of our focus areas right now, Spanish language materials, for example, because we have a growing Spanish language population here in Oregon. Outreach to small businesses who may not have safety professionals on staff. If we can make 1 hour prior to the workday or noon hour programs available to help them with safety issues, for example. In our workers' compensation division, we administer and enforce the workers' compensation law. We work to ensure that employers have workers' compensation coverage and that workers get timely benefits. We have a couple of ombudsmen, which are always available to you to assist with constituent issues, the injured workers' ombudsman and the small business ombudsman in workers' comp. We house the workers' compensation board, which resolves disputes. And we work closely with the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which is a collaborative group that brings forward recommendations about improvements to the workers' compensation system. And I think you know we've had a lot of success with workers' compensation here in Oregon in keeping rates low, but also keeping benefits high. I want to then move to some of our more directly consumer protection-focused areas, and I'm going to start with insurance. And in insurance, and by the way, I should say, please feel free to interrupt at any time if you've got questions or if I've skipped over something. Or, as I said to the chair, feel free to speed me up if I'm spending too long on something that you're not interested in. Our next major program area is insurance. And in insurance, we monitor insurance companies' financial solvency to make sure that a company is going to be able to pay claims when the claims come due. We enforce insurance laws that are aimed at fair treatment of consumers and protection of the insurance buying public. That includes review of some but not all insurance rates and policy forms. We provide consumer education, and we have a consumer advocacy staff that works with individuals to resolve insurance-related complaints. And that consumer advocacy staff, in addition to working on an individual basis to solve problems, also helps us identify larger-scale problems and trends, which in turn then inform the recommendations that we make to you and also the regulatory work that we do. Mr. Ario sometimes refers to that as an ongoing focus group because it's a daily way to hear about what insurance problems Oregonians are experiencing. An example of what's come out of that group was last session's bill that put limits on how homeowners insurance companies could make use of claims histories. That was a problem that we heard a lot about, and that bill was a direct result of it. This session, we are proposing a couple of bills, which, again, come out of those types of concerns that we hear. And one of them, actually, I believe, is scheduled for this committee next week. It's House Bill 2221, which would address the issue of medical discount cards. And a medical discount card is not an insurance product. It is the legitimate medical discount card. Cards are negotiated provider networks of discounted medical services, and if you purchase this card, you're entitled to those discounts. But there are also programs which are misleading or fraudulent, and so this bill would require registration of those programs, and as well as some additional protections like a free look period, good consumer disclosure. So you will be you'll be hearing about that one in detail next week. That's if you ever come see your fax machine in the morning with one of those faxes that says provide health coverage for your family for $29 a month, it's probably one of the non-legitimate versions of the medical discount cards. One of the other bills that probably will not come to this committee but rather one of the health committees, but that has also come out of that advocacy work that we do, deals with health insurance transparency. Transparency is a major focus of ours across as we look at healthcare issues, making sure that consumers can make good choices. And this bill, which is House Bill 2213, will require health insurance companies to provide more cost information to consumers who are making healthcare choices and want to know how much their insurance will pay for and how much will be their responsibility, depending on what the medical need is and what the provider is and what the insurance plan is. We have incidentally just put out a major report on health insurance in Oregon, and I believe in your packet we've given you the executive summary of that report. And if you're interested in health insurance issues, the full report is on our website, and I would certainly encourage you to look at it, or we will be happy to get you copies. The executive summary looks like this. And we have made some recommendations in that report as well, dealing with health insurance issues. An overall area of concern in insurance, in health insurance as well as other areas, is affordability and availability. And we do address those areas. One of the subjects or the areas that's been a subject of a lot of legislative discussion in some past sessions has been medical malpractice insurance. And we actually are seeing, the market in that area tends to be cyclical, and we are seeing it soften. We have seen some rate decreases in medical malpractice. Legislatively, in 2003, you probably recall, the legislature adopted a program to help ameliorate the cost of medical malpractice insurance for rural providers. That bill has a sunset. It will is scheduled to end at the end of 2007. We do have a bill, which is Senate Bill 183, which would extend that program, but also fine-tune it in terms of who is eligible for it. So that will be coming forward. Another area where we have seen concerns about affordability is in construction liability insurance. And last session, that resulted in a bill to establish a task force to look at the underlying issues relating to construction liability insurance and also construction quality. And as quite a number of you are aware, the result of that was a construction claims task force that has been working for the last year and a half to look at construction quality in Oregon and make recommendations. And this morning they had their final meeting and adopted their report. The executive summary of that one as well is in your package, and it looks like this. And there are quite a number of substantial recommendations coming forward from that task force, which I'm actually going to talk about in a little more detail when I get to building codes, but I did want to flag that for you. Some other insurance-related projects that we've been working on and some that will produce legislation or this session or at least proposed legislation. One resulting from legislation last time is we have implemented the mental health parity bill. Those rules have just gone into effect at the beginning of this year. And so for people with commercial health insurance, they are now entitled to parity, but obviously there are a lot of open questions, so we're going to be continuing to monitor that issue very closely. This past couple of years, there's been some national attention paid to issues having to do with insurance brokers and how they are compensated and the extent to which that compensation is disclosed. That's an issue that we have been addressing through rulemaking, and there also have been some enforcement actions. Another area that we spend some time thinking about in insurance recently is long-term care insurance. With our aging population, many people are very interested in long-term care insurance as a way to preserve their assets. We have a strong interest in making sure that long-term care insurance is a good value for consumers and that they're protected against rate increases later on, and that the product is also portable as people move from state to state. So there are some of issues relating to long-term care insurance we've been able to address by rule. We do have some legislation which will be coming forward, Senate Bill 191, in cooperation with the Department of Human Services, to increase some education requirements for people who market long-term care insurance, and also to qualify our program here in Oregon for the federal partnership program, which provides that for people who purchase long-term care insurance, they get some relief from the spend-down provisions. One other insurance bill that you will be, I believe, seeing in this committee deals with interstate cooperation with respect to life insurance and annuities. Those are products like long-term care insurance that people tend to buy and then intend to keep as they move from state to state. So a lot of these products are marketed nationally. Insurance is regulated at the state level throughout the United States. A number of states have formed a compact to have multi-state approval of these life insurance products, and our bill would allow us, if we conclude that the standards are sufficiently protective of consumers, would allow us to make use of that interstate mechanism. So that bill, too, you will be hearing more about as we go forward. Back to health insurance for a moment, I should mention that we are also engaged in some of the broader discussions about healthcare access, and we are working on the Healthy Kids Initiative, which is, I know, going to be a subject of much interest and discussion. And in our department, in addition to the regulation of insurance, we have a couple of other health insurance-related programs that I just wanted to flag for you. One of them is the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and that's how we in Oregon make health insurance available to people who, for reasons of health, are unable to buy it in the private market. They get turned down for health insurance as an individual, and they're not qualified for group insurance. So the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool provides coverage for those high-risk industries. They pay a market-based premium, and then the rest is made up through an assessment that's paid by health insurance companies. The additional health insurance program that we run is the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program. That sponsors a volunteer network that provides counseling to seniors about their health insurance choices. I believe we have one of that's called SHIBA, and I believe we have one of those brochures in the packet as well, and you may well have constituents, elderly constituents who have health insurance questions, and you are more than welcome to refer them to the SHIBA program for help. Moving on from insurance, unless there are other insurance-related questions at the moment, I do want to talk next about building codes. And as you may know, our building codes division is responsible for the adoption and interpretation of a consistent statewide set of building codes. And we also do statewide licensing of electricians, plumbers, construction inspectors. But in the areas of plumbing and electrical, mechanical, structural, permitting and inspection, it's shared responsibility between the state and local jurisdictions. So a city or county can engage in those activities themselves, or in the areas where the cities and counties don't wish to run the program, the state will run the program. So there are actually 132 separate building code jurisdictions in the state of Oregon, as some of you know, and I want to talk a little about some of the issues that raises and some of how we're addressing them. We do provide statewide inspections in several areas, elevators, boilers, and manufactured housing. A major focus for us in building codes is on streamlined regulatory processes, as well as improving customer service and statewide consistency. And I think all of you are aware of what a critical role is played in the Oregon economy by the construction industry. And so we have a great interest in making sure that that industry can move briskly. Time is money in the construction industry, and anything we can do to make the process move more quickly is a benefit to that whole economic sector, as well as then, of course, the ultimate customers who pay the costs of a more expensive building code system. Over the past few years, we have implemented a pilot project to allow contractors to purchase simple permits online. The program began in the Portland metropolitan area, but we are expanding it statewide. The Lane County area, Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County are all participating right now, as is Medford. And we're in discussions with a number of others. That is a fairly limited program, but one of our priorities for this session is to start work on a statewide e-permitting, electronic permitting system that would handle the more complex permits, as well as online scheduling of inspections, plan review, and the more complex tasks. So we're very excited about that. As I mentioned, our building codes division, as well as our insurance division, have provided staff for as well as the Construction Contractors Board, which incidentally is not part of DCBS. There is sometimes confusion about that. Construction Contractors Board is an independent agency that licenses contractors. We provide the licensing of specific trades and contractors who are electricians and plumbing, for example. Both of those agencies, as well as the insurance division, have been engaged in the efforts of this task force. And so the series of recommendations, which is coming forward from the task force and which I believe this committee will have jurisdiction over, a lot of them focus on moisture intrusion, which was identified as one of the major concerns. Some of them are administrative, and we can address through building codes changes, but there will also be recommendations concerning more education, both consumer education and on the contractor side, certification for people who work on the building envelope, that is the roof, the walls, the windows, places where moisture can intrude, greater enforcement powers, and on the insurance side, first-party warranties, a recommendation to expand the insurance requirement to include completed operations coverage, and some removal of barriers to group liability coverage, as well as encouragement of voluntary loss control discounts. So those are all areas that are covered in great detail in this report, and I know, or at least I assume that this committee will be spending more time on those, and we will, of course, be happy to consult and assist in any way that we can. If there are questions about building codes issues at this point, I would be happy to answer them, or otherwise I can move on to the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities.
Small questions, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gillian.
I'm just, who does the contractor area come under?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, the Construction Contractors Board is actually a governing board. That is, they hire an executive director to staff that independent agency. The board itself is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
I did not know that. Thank you.
Our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities actually has, I believe it's now 14 separate programs, quite a variety. That it includes state chartered financial institute depository institutions, banks, and credit unions. And in this country, there is a dual chartering system, so that a bank or a credit union can have a federal charter, in which case we do not regulate it, we are precluded from regulating it, or they can choose to be chartered at the state level. And we have a very robust state chartered banking and credit union industry here. Often the state chartered banks and credit unions like dealing with a local regulator, and often a local bank, a local credit union, will meet local needs in a way that a national bank might not. So it's an industry that we appreciate having here and like to encourage. We also regulate mortgage lenders and mortgage brokers, consumer finance lenders, including short-term consumer finance lenders, who you know as payday and car title lenders, pawn brokers, a number of smaller programs such as pre-need funeral trusts, for example, money transmitters. We license collection agencies. And in the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, actually, we have recently transferred over the licensing of manufactured housing dealers, which we other portions of the manufactured housing program remain in our building codes division. Our goal in the Division of Finance, that we also enforce the state securities laws. So this is actually a very active consumer protection area. And we put one of our brochures in the packet that looks like this. I will say, though, and we have some insurance ones in here, this is only a selection. We actually do have quite a variety of consumer materials. And if any of you in town hall meetings or other types of constituent outreach are interested in any of these consumer protection materials, we would be happy to provide them, as well as, of course, work with your constituents. And we do a fair amount of consumer education in this division, trying to make people good financial consumers. And, you know, the best way to defend against fraud is to make sure that we have smart consumers who recognize it and don't fall for it. And, you know, we're very proud of the instances where, we, for example, get a phone call from somebody who said, I was at one of your presentations, and you said that if an investment was presented to me that had this, this, and this characteristic, I should call you to find out if it's legitimate. Is this legitimate? And we say, why, no, it's not. It's not registered. And we have people say, thank you. If I had not attended that presentation, I would have said yes to this. So those are the types of things that are success stories for us. But we also do enforcement, and we close down scams. We do criminal prosecutions. We work collaboratively with local law enforcement, with the Department of Justice in appropriate cases. So that is a very active area of ours. With respect to consumer finance lending, of course, that's been a very active subject of interest. The legislature, during the special session, passed new restrictions on payday lenders. We have a package of bills, which you will be seeing, I'm sure, following up on that action. One of them deals with the payday lending, follow-up on payday lending itself. Our bill is House Bill 2203, and it will extend payday lending regulation to out-of-state lenders who lend to Oregonians located here, and frequently those are Internet lenders. And we believe that whatever the law is that protects Oregonians, it should apply whether or not that lender is a brick-and-mortar lender or an Internet lender. The other portion of that bill, major portion of that bill, will be a compliance database, so that the provisions of existing law dealing with rollovers and limits on loans can in fact be more easily enforced. We are proposing House Bill 2204, which would cap the fees and interest on car title loans to match the payday lending law. And House Bill 2205 addresses an issue which we have actually recently addressed by rule, and that is the problem of payday lenders switching their license types to what are called conventional consumer finance licenses so as not to be subject to the payday lending, the new payday lending law. By law, a payday loan is defined as a short-term loan, 60 days or less, so someone who wants to do 61-day loans would not be doing payday loans. What we have done by rule is to say, is to define the business of the conventional finance lender as the type of business that it has always been. And those are the traditional consumer finance lenders who make longer term loans, installment loans. They're based on credit underwriting. They're amortizing loans, which means you make equal monthly payments and pay the loan off. They have experienced personnel. That type of industry has been in existence in Oregon for a long time. So we've recently issued rules saying if you have that type of license, that's what your business needs to look like. Now, we believe that we have authority to do that by rule, but during the rulemaking process, some of the payday lenders did question whether we had the legal authority to do that. So in this bill, proposed bill, House Bill 2205, we are requesting the legislature to codify the rules to remove any question about that authority. The final bill in this package deals with a slightly different kind of high-cost financial service, and that is check cashing. And many of the same storefronts that provide these other services also provide check cashing. And I want to be clear that we support the existence of financial services for people who need them, including short-term loans for people who need them. We do recognize that there is a need for short-term loans. There is a need for check cashing for people who don't have other types of financial resources available, and we work to expand those. I think several of you are aware that we worked with Oregon's credit union industry to offer payday-type loans to their members on make those loans available at a lower cost. So check cashing as well. We do understand there are people who do not have bank accounts and for whom check cashing is a need. But for people who cash payday and government checks, those are generally low-risk checks. Many states do cap fees on the cashing those types of checks. So this bill, House Bill 2202, does propose licensing of check cashers and a cap on fees for government and payroll checks. And I believe that bill is also on your schedule for next week. So we will look forward to discussing that in more detail with you then. A couple of other programs that we're working on in this area. One of them, I think many of you are familiar with, is ID theft. It's a priority for us. It's a priority for many legislators. It's a priority for the governor. And I know a number of you have been involved in that last session and through the interim. And there is a group of stakeholders, I believe, meeting as we speak, work from throughout the financial services industry, consumer groups, and a number of legislators have participated or kept abreast of that. And we are looking forward to a bill coming forward on ID theft, including key consumer protections, having businesses that maintain personal data, meet some standards in terms of safeguarding that data. In the event that data is stolen, and that will happen, I think we all understand that it is impossible to prevent altogether, making sure that consumers are notified and then have the ability to freeze their credit accounts so that the data cannot be misused by a wrongdoer. And so those elements, I think, are very likely to come before you in a bill. We're looking forward to seeing that. One other area that I wanted to mention before I close, we don't have legislative proposals on, but it is an area that we're paying quite a bit of attention to and have taken some administrative actions, and that is mortgage lending. And for many Oregonians, taking out a mortgage is the single largest financial decision they will ever make. And we are in a situation where we have had low interest rates and we have had rapidly appreciating housing prices. And, of course, there's a great desire and need for home ownership. And one result has been a proliferation of mortgage products that create risks for people. Not only the traditional ARM, adjustable rate mortgage, but also sometimes interest-only mortgages with balloon payments, even negative amortization mortgages where your monthly payment does not pay even the interest that's due. And our concern is that as interest rates start to edge up and housing appreciation starts to level off, we may have consumers who are in situations that they really cannot financially handle. And we are worried that about that, and we're worried about it from the consumer standpoint and also the implications for the financial markets. We are taking a number of steps, including increased consumer education. We are just in the process of finalizing some rules to increase the oversight over loan originators, who are the ones who are on in the face-to-face relationship. We are looking at greater collaboration with the appropriate regulatory agencies to make sure that appraisals are not unduly inflated and that there is not pressure to inflate appraisals in order to get a loan. We are issuing guidance, paralleling some guidance that's just been issued recently by federal regulators to the federally regulated part of this industry to have better disclosure and some additional standards for these more creative types of mortgage products. So there's quite a lot going on in that area that I wanted to flag for you. As I say, we do not have legislative proposals, and we don't know whether any will be coming forward, but certainly it's an issue that's on our horizon as a potential problem coming up that we'd rather be out front of. So that's an overview of our major consumer protection areas. Probably a lot of listening to me, and you may have questions, or you may be may have heard enough about the department for the moment. But we do look forward to continuing discussions on a great number of these issues.
Does the committee have any questions they'd like to pose?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. Mr. Reisinger, on the interest-only loans, have any states, particularly our neighboring states, enacted any state legislation on those regarding the interest-only, the mortgage issues you were talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, there are some states that do have some statutes dealing with the consequences of foreclosure and protection for consumers, and we're just beginning to take a look at those, but we would be happy to provide you what we have. It's my understanding that a report was recently issued doing a state-by-state comparison, and we can probably get our hands on that for you fairly easily.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Galizio.
Just while we have you here, Ms. Dressinger, I mean, there are a myriad of issues and areas, so my question is not any kind of a critique, but I'm just curious, you know, you mentioned the mortgage lending is one area sort of on the horizon. Any other things that you see out there that are starting to kind of catch your eye?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, good question. There are always new varieties of scams, and there are the medical discount cards issue is an example of something where I would say we don't have a large problem in Oregon yet. We have seen it in other states, Florida, for example, and so that's one which we're trying to actually get in front of. If you were to say to me today, is this a huge problem today, I would say no, but we don't want it to become one. In terms of other, I would have to ponder whether there's other things on the horizon. I sort of gave you the big picture ones, and of course the dangerous ones are the ones that we haven't thought of yet. So, if any of you have any of those that you want to put on our plate, you know our phone numbers.
Any other questions from the committee, Mr. Reisinger?
Well, I have one just real briefly on your. When you mentioned at the very end about the loan origination and the appraisal issue in the loan industry that you're starting to look at and looking at tightening education and supervision requirements, has there been issues that have come forward that have caused you to go down this road? I assume there must be, you know, because I guess I somewhat understand the banking industry and the real estate industry have pretty stringent, or at least I thought they did, educational requirements for those positions. And in the past, I've just always thought that they were pretty well regulated. And so you've identified an issue that where you feel that the DCBS needs to step in and give some direction to this industry? Does that sum it up somewhat?
Mr. Chair, a couple of responses. One of them is we have seen an increase in complaints, And we actually held a public forum to sort of see what people's concerns were. And the appraisal issue was one that we heard a lot about at that public forum. We hadn't heard a lot about it before. The complaints we get often are about bait and switch type of concerns, people not feeling that they did not know and were not told what some of the consequences were of the product. For example, not understanding that there was a prepayment penalty that would preclude them from switching to a different mortgage. The mortgage industry is fairly fragmented. You can get a mortgage from a bank or from a credit union or from a consumer finance lender or from a mortgage broker or mortgage banker, which we regulate at the state level. On the education arena, for example, we do have an education requirement today for loan originators, but a loan originator is not required to comply with the education requirement until they've been licensed for 6 months. So the change that we're making is to say you actually need to comply with it first before you become licensed. It seems like a common sense mm-hmm. response. The requirement for greater supervision, most of the industry we do not have problems with, but there are some, outliers where we do see problems, we do hear about problems.
Thank you. And in regards to the appraisal, are they not subject to licensing currently?
Mr. Chair, yes, they are, and not by us, by the Appraiser Licensure Board. And so what we are trying to do is to work collaboratively with them and make sure that if we hear concerns or if they hear concerns that relate to the other one's industry, that we work together on those. For example, if an appraiser feels that a mortgage lender has inappropriately pressured them to engage in inappropriate practice, that's on our plate to take care of. So we do want to hear about those.
So just to clarify that you're not really proposing to bring education and training of appraisers under your department. That's going to remain...
Correct, Mr. Chair. We are not proposing that at all.
Thank you. Committee, have any last questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
Sergeant.
You.
Very enlightening, and I think it gives us a little good overview of your agency, which I'm sure we'll become more familiar with as the session goes on.
Thank you very much.
I think we'll move right into our next invited testimony. Attorney in charge from the Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Division, Drew Lionopoulos. Tried that twice. Did I get it right one
yes,
of the times?
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, great.
Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Drew Lionopoulos. I am the attorney in charge of the financial fraud section at the Oregon Department of Justice. That basically means I'm the head of the Attorney General's Consumer Protection section. I've given you a copy of my written testimony, and I'd like to just give you a quick preview of that before going into more detail. I'll be doing a quick overview of my section, describe our consumer complaint process for you, describe some of our prevention efforts, tell you how we work with some other government agencies in the private sector, and discuss the primary law that we use in our enforcement efforts. That's the Unlawful Trade Practice Act. I'll go through some of our section's personnel and resources and end with a quick description of our 7 proposed consumer protection bills for this session. First, the overview. My section, the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection section, is part of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. We're a civil, not a criminal, law enforcement agency. Our goal is basically to ensure a fair and free marketplace that operates on a level playing field. We believe that education in consumer protection matters is the best way to achieve those goals. When education fails, we believe in taking strong and effective enforcement action. Our mission statement is set out on page one of the testimony that I've provided you. It's very short. I'd encourage you to read it. It really does describe what we do pretty well, and we take it to heart in our section. Let me briefly describe for you our consumer complaint and management process for you. Consumer complaints are one measure that we use to identify problems in the marketplace. We have typically between 20 and 25 volunteers who work in our office who staff our toll-free consumer protection hotline from 8:30 to 4:30 in the afternoon, 5 days a week. We also have an automated hotline that runs 24/7 that has a information phone tree that consumers can find out information on a wide variety of subjects. Last biennium from June 04 to July 06, those volunteers fielded approximately 71,000 consumer complaint calls personally. Total calls to the hotline over that same period were just over 100,000. Typically, a consumer will call into our hotline with some either question about a business or maybe a complaint about a transaction. The volunteer will offer them some information about that particular business, let them know if we've had any contacts with that business in the past. Listen to the nature of the complaint, and in all possibility offer the consumer the opportunity to file a written complaint with our office, either in hard copy or electronically through our consumer protection website. During that, again, June 04 to July 06 period, that website had over a quarter of a million hits. Our office is physically located in Salem, actually almost across the street from here, 12th and State Street. We also have a walk-in service for consumers who want to discuss in person with a representative of our office their complaint or file a complaint in person. And we offer our services in English and Spanish. That's been the case for the time that I've been with that office, which is the last 12 years. From, again, June 04 to July 06 period, we reviewed and assisted over 20,000 consumers with consumer complaints. Approximately 7,500 of those were filed online. Typically, those written consumer complaints will be assigned to one of our four enforcement officers. They are some of the more senior people who have been with our office, and they typically make contact with the consumer, either in person or in writing, or over the phone or in writing, and then typically write to the business to get, quote-unquote, the business's side of the story. And depending on the facts that they're able to ascertain, will usually act as a mediator between the consumer and the business to try to resolve to both party satisfactions that individual complaint, if that looks like it's reasonably possible to do so. The other important function that the enforcement officers serve is they really are the ones who identify for the lawyers in the office what they believe to be the patterns and practices that they're seeing of unlawful or potentially unlawful conduct, as opposed to the isolated instances of either a misunderstanding or just a bad transaction here and there. Typically, the enforcement officers will, when they identify a pattern and practice of what they believe to be unlawful conduct, they'll refer the matter up the chain of command to some of the lawyers in the section, including myself, who will then make a determination as to whether the case should be opened for a formal investigation and or enforcement action. Next, I'd like to discuss a little bit our prevention efforts. We really do believe that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. We publish and distribute a wide variety of educational pamphlets and materials, ranging from how to buy a manufactured home to immigration fraud. We have a very active consumer information coordinator, Jan Margosian, who is a regular speaker at events around the state. She also handles our extensive press releases. We participate in a number of outreach-type programs. Some of these are in conjunction with federal and local government agencies. The Oregon Safe Cyberspace Initiative is a good example of a partnership that we've entered into with the federal government, the Federal Trade Commission, U.S. Department of Justice, and ourselves on the government side, in conjunction with a wide variety of high-tech providers. And the lofty goal of that program really is to clean up the internet, and we're very proud of the fact that we play an active role in that program that was initiated by the Federal Trade Commission, and Oregon was chosen as the pilot state for that program nationally. And we'd like to think that the partnership with our office was one of the reasons why we were chosen as the first pilot state for what we're all hoping is going to be a very successful rollout of a national program. The Attorney General himself, Hardy Myers, has been involved in a series of what we call Protect Yourself and Family speaking forums across the state on a wide variety of topics, including consumer fraud issues, methamphetamine abuse, internet crimes, and elder abuse. I'd like to now move to some of the cooperative ventures that we have entered into with some business trade associations, car dealers, telecommunications providers. We meet regularly with many of those groups to identify and iron out problems before they get out of hand, establish best practices, and to explain to them up front what our enforcement policies are so that it does not come as a surprise later on. We really pride ourselves on working well with other agencies. We coordinate many of our actions with our counterparts in other state attorneys general's offices through multi-state investigations and prosecutions. We also team up with a variety of other local, state, and federal agencies. In the last couple of years, we've successfully worked with the Federal Trade Commission, the FDA, U.S. Department of Justice, Oregon State Police, Department of Consumer and Business Services, as well as local DAs, just to name a few. We provide training to many of those agencies in our area of expertise, Oregon Consumer Protection Law, and specifically the Unlawful Trade Practice Act. That's the next item that I'd like to briefly go over with you. Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practice Act, commonly known as the Consumer Protection Law in the state, is the law that we employ most of the time in our enforcement actions. It's found in Oregon Revised Statute 646.605. The law technically allows government enforcement by both the Attorney General's office and local DAs, although the last DA-based consumer protection program in Oregon ended in the mid-1980s, mostly because of funding issues, I suspect. So for the last 20 years or so, we have been the only government enforcer of that particular law. And I say government enforcer because the Unlawful Trade Practice Act also provides a private remedy, a private cause of action that many private attorneys do utilize in bringing individual consumer protection actions where they actually represent consumers who are suing a business. My section, the Attorney General's Office, by law, may only represent the state. When we bring an enforcement action, we don't do it on behalf of consumers, although consumers may be a direct beneficiary of those actions in the form of refunds and restitution that's recovered. But we do not technically represent the consumer. We represent, by law, as we only we can, the state of Oregon as our only client. The Unlawful Trade Practice Act here basically, in Oregon, basically provides a laundry list of prohibited activities. They are from the very general to, for example, the prohibition against engaging in unconscionable sales tactics, to the very specific, thou shall not sell a device with a mercury switch in it, for instance. There are, at last count, some 50 or so specific prohibitions in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Not every consumer transaction is covered by the Unlawful Trade Practice Act in this state. Some are specifically excluded from the act, including landlord-tenant, generally speaking, insurance matters, loans and the extension of credit, many of the areas that Corey Streisinger was just discussing actually are handled by other agencies in the state. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is certainly the other major player in the area here. In most cases, the Unlawful Trade Practice Act requires us to give businesses a 10-day notice of the fact that we see a problem and that we are we're authorized to file a lawsuit, and the business has 10 days in which to remedy what we believe to be the violation through executing and submitting to us an assurance of voluntary compliance. That's a document that it does not admit any liability or wrongdoing. We require that the company stop the particular practice that we are investigating, that that they engage in a variety of remedial actions, which may include making refunds and restitution, and that they agree not to violate the law in the future. Those assurances of voluntary compliances are filed with the court, typically the county in which the business is doing, in which the business is operating, or if it's a statewide business or an internet business, we typically would file it in Marion County. And violation of an assurance of voluntary compliance can constitute contempt of court. If we are not able to settle a matter with an acceptable assurance of voluntary compliance, we can file a lawsuit seeking substantial civil penalties, injunctive relief, costs, and fees. The only real exception to the 10-day requirement that we give them notice and an opportunity to sign an assurance is if there is an immediate threat to the public welfare, safety, that's imminent. In that case, we're authorized to file immediate actions without giving the business the opportunity to execute an assurance. The vast majority of our cases are settled through an assurance of voluntary compliance or a similar settlement document. In your materials, I've listed some examples of recent settlements that we've entered. You'll find that on page 4. I've just picked three recently entered into a large multi-state settlement with drug manufacturer Warner Lambert concerning their promotion of off-label uses of the drug Neurontin. We also entered into several multi-state settlements in the form of assurances of voluntary compliance with many national convenience stores and mini-marts, 7-Elevens, Conoco's for selling cigarettes to underage minors. And last example, we recently entered into an assurance of voluntary compliance with Hillsborough-based SoloFlex to end its misleading advertising claims regarding its whole-body vibration platforms that were targeting the frail and the elderly. You may have seen the ad. It had a senior citizen standing on the whole vibration platform with their walker held above their head. Mm-hmm. The implication, obviously, was buy this product as an octogenarian, and you too will be able to get rid of your walker. We frowned upon that advertisement. We also enforce state and federal antitrust law. These actions typically are coordinated with other states and the feds. They usually involve allegations of price fixing or attempts to unlawfully monopolize or restrain trade. Next, I'd like to briefly touch upon our funding and personnel. Up until 2003, the section was funded through two sources. First, general funds, typically around a third of our budget, and second, recoveries that we made from the enforcement actions that we took against businesses. In 2003, the Legislative Assembly suspended all of our general funding for our sections, and there has not been a restoration of that funding. As a result, we've been self-funded through our enforcement actions since that time. We happily project that this self-funding is sustainable at least through the 07-09 biennium, but certainly not indefinitely. Currently, the section's comprised of 10 lawyers, 6 investigators, 4 enforcement officers, 4 paralegals, 9 support staff, including a supervisor, our consumer information coordinator, a volunteer coordinator, and right now, 23 consumer hotline volunteers. Last, I'd like to briefly move on to our legislative proposals for this session. We anticipate these will be introduced in Senator Prozanski's Senate Commerce Committee, and we've already met with him about these. First, Senate Bill 116 would ban predatory towing practices, require towing price disclosures, and provide remedies for violations thereof under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Senate Bill 117 would basically get us back into the no-call enforcement business, which is currently being handled by the Federal Trade Commission. Next, Senate Bill 118 would ban price gouging, such as that we've seen in the wake of natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, and authorize the governor to proclaim abnormal disruptions in the market. Senate Bill 119 would provide DOJ with the with authority to enforce certain securities laws. Senate Bill 120 would make violations of Oregon's unlawful debt collection practices, which is currently only a private right of action in this state, would make that also a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and allow us to enforce violations of the Unlawful Debt Collections Act. Next, Senate Bill 121 relates to unclaimed damages in private class action lawsuits. It would basically allow the Attorney General to make a claim for those damages so that they can go back to the state. I believe the current version has the unclaimed damages going back to the Common School Fund now. Currently, those unclaimed damages go back to the defendant or tortfeasor. And Senate Bill 122 is the only new proposal that we have this year. The other 6 had been introduced in prior legislative sessions. None of them had passed. We are very hopeful we'll do better this session. But Senate Bill 122 is a new one, and that would ban the use of live checks or promotional checks. And Live checks are typically those small checks that you may or may not have seen in the mail. They're usually less than $5, sometimes maybe up to $10, $3.50. It's an actual check somewhere on mouse print. In the back of the check or somewhere there is something about the fact that when you cash the check, you are hereby signing up for some service that you've never heard of and probably don't want for $30 a month that will be automatically deducted from the account to which you deposit this check. That particular practice is actually probably a bigger problem for businesses than it is for consumers. These checks typically come into a business's accounts payable section. They are endorsed routinely, deposited, and then the monthly deductions begin, and it may be a long time before anybody figures out what those are for. We have also, our section has also actively participated in the ID theft working group that Corey Streisinger referred to in her testimony, and we're also very hopeful that that working group will achieve a very robust identity theft protection law and breach notification law in the state this session. Thanks very much for the opportunity to highlight some of the work that we do, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Anyone on the committee have questions?
I have a question, Chair. Thank you. With regard to the statement about the agreement for selling tobacco products to minors, is that a separate statute, or is it somehow under unlawful trade practices, or where does the violation come from there?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, very good question. We have, I just want to back up one or two steps. In the late 1990s, a group of many attorneys generals, including Oregon, filed a series of lawsuits around the country against major tobacco companies concerning their marketing and sales of the manufacturers weren't selling. They were doing the marketing and the information that was being presented about tobacco products. Those lawsuits led to the execution of a master settlement agreement with the tobacco companies. That happened in the late 1990s. Since that time, the attorneys general have been very active in both monitoring compliance with the master settlement agreement and generally looking at what is going on with the marketing and sales of tobacco products. One of the theories of liability that was advanced in those particular lawsuits were that the marketing efforts targeting campaigns towards youth constituted unconscionable conduct. We view the sales of the cigarettes to minors as an extension of unconscionable conduct, not checking someone's ID. There is specifically a statute dealing with the sale of tobacco products to minors. That's not what these theories of liabilities concerned of.
Thank you.
And yes.
I have another question. I'm sorry, I couldn't combine them because they don't have anything to do with each other.
Yes.
I wanted to ask about the suspension of general funding. Are there proposals now to restore that funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, no. For 2007-09, we have not proposed restoring that general funding. We have been successful at we have played the hand that we've been dealt, and we have we are able to sustain the program through the current biennium, so we will not be seeking general funds in this coming biennium. I strongly suspect that that will not be the case forever.
Thank you.
Well, I was actually going to ask, that was kind of the question where I was going, because I was going to say that, and I saw some movement amongst your colleagues when you were saying you're not going to be asking for, but anyway, I guess I was kind of wondering, you know, if somebody said, hey, look, you've been successful sort of self-funding, so therefore it appears that you wouldn't need future funding. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I think it's an accurate statement as far as it goes. We've been successful in the short term. I don't think that it is feasible to run a program like ours in the long term on this type of model. I really question the policy choice that's being adopted by requiring the program to be run on that model.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, I was just wondering, on the live checks that are less than $10, does that include the legislative paychecks? No, you don't have to answer that question. All right.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Gilliam.
Question, Mr. Chair. First of all, could you clarify for me on the proposed bill 121? I didn't catch where the unclaimed damages are going. Tell me a little bit more about that, please.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Gillum, currently the unclaimed damages in a private class action lawsuit will revert to the defendant, the tortfeasor. So unless there's a specific provision otherwise, if there are unclaimed damages in the class action, they're going back to the defendant.
And then he mentioned some of it was, are you proposing it goes to a school fund, or I didn't understand, I'm just sorry, I don't understand how that works.
Representative, we'll probably be reviewing that bill in a public hearing, and it wasn't my intent to really have a public hearing on a bill that may be coming to our committee in the future, so I just wanted more of an overview of their proposals instead of specifics about the bills. Thank you. Any other questions?
Just one more question, Chair. Thank you. The complaint department and the calls that come in, have you had a lot of calls about negative option programs where, for example, the consumer gets a book and then they continue sending books until the consumer lets them know that they want to end the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes, we have, although I'm not sure if we have a specific category to track negative options. I'd have to check on that or not, but it is definitely a source of complaints, no question about it.
Well, I guess that leaves a question for me, a much more basic question. There's reference to your top 10 list, and I would be interested that our committee get a copy of the top 10 list and perhaps, you know, where most of the enforcement action of your department comes in regards to those issue areas, and also where the most economic impacts or damages are also kind of on a spreadsheet, if you will, on some of those issue areas. If you can provide that to this committee at a later date, that would really be helpful for us to see where the action is, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, we can definitely provide that to your committee. We typically issue the top 10 list the first week of February. That coincides with Consumer Protection Week. We're just now in the process, quite frankly, of crunching those numbers and compiling that list. Would the beginning of February be a suitable time?
Well, it sounds like it might have to be.
Well, we can probably move that up, but again, we like to get a little bit of a...
It'd just be good information for this committee, I believe. It's, you know, so whenever you're able to get us some information on that, it would be helpful.
We will, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee at this time? You know, I know there's a lot of folks in the audience who've been sitting here very attentively and I just provided some invited testimony, but I am going to offer an opportunity for anybody who wants to make some comments, not about specific bills that will be coming before the committee, but maybe just general statements. An opportunity is open to you if you so wish. Please approach the dais and... And I might add, this needs to be related to consumer protection, I hope. And could you state your name and address for the record, please?
My name is James Bila, 3412 Southeast 160th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. I'm president and founder of Oregon Earthquake Awareness. I gave you a document from FEMA which deals with earthquake safety in homes.
I think you're in the wrong committee for that. With all due politeness, you probably need to be in a different earthquake area, I suppose. Is that? I'm confused.
No, the
about consumer protection, not earthquake
right,
preparedness.
Right, and the consumer protection issue is that in Oregon we have a different building code than they do in the state of Washington and the state of California. And the consumer protection issue is that in Oregon, in violation of statute, the national model code requirements for seismic design that would protect a consumer in an earthquake are deliberately taken out of the Oregon Code with the great complicity of the home building industry. And I tried to present those very books that I gave to you to the Construction Claim Task Force because it had been an issue before them, and I was prohibited from the Building Codes Division staff from doing that. One of the consumer protection issues is the we have very many boards and commissions that are government appointed, and one of the ways that you can protect consumers, there is no requirement for applicants, appointees, to be present at their confirmation hearings. So there's no, an applicant does not have to answer a question from a representative. And this would be an important issue if people are going to boards that would be disposed to arbitrarily weaken a national model code standard, then I think that is a question that deserves to be raised. I've spent, since the year 2000, I've tried to get, both from the Building Code Division and from the Attorney General, the Attorney General's opinion or letter of advice on how a board member, under what circumstances a board member may be removed from a board. And I still have no answer.
Well, you know, I appreciate your comments, and maybe, you know, I'm going to have to direct you to my committee administrator to take a few notes from your issue, and maybe we can help direct you to someone to talk to about this.
I don't know if we're prepared to go into a review of building codes. It's a big subject. We will be looking at building codes a little bit this session, and I think that's something that I appreciate the concern you have there. I share some of the same concern about building codes in general, and I think we will take a look at some of those issues later in this committee. But you've given us something to look at, and I'd like to get your name and number, and let's kind of hash some of this out and see if there's another place in our future agenda that we could get you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do I have any other public testimony or points of view, statements? If not, I believe I would bring this committee to a close, and we will be meeting again on Wednesday at 1 o'clock in Hearing Room E, right here. Thank you very much.